Okay, girls, today I'm giving you the inside scoop on my favorite place to save this spring. At Ross, it's the spot to get everything you need at prices you'll love. Because when you find brand names for 20 to 60% off other retailers' prices, you'll definitely be finding your next favorite outfit and more. Trust me, you don't want to miss out on these deals on your favorite dresses and tops. And at this price, you might as well throw in a new purse or pair of shoes too. But Ross isn't just about savings, they're about giving back. This year, Ross and their customers raised over $4.1 million to support the Boys and Girls Club and local youth programs to help kids and families thrive. Seriously, just visit your local Ross and see for yourself, because I know you like to keep your closet full and your costs low. So what are you waiting for? Say yes for less at your local Ross.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
All right, welcome back to another initial reactions episode. This time, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 here on Friends from Work. This is a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe and sometimes slightly not in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Check out Screensaver. And it's a podcast that is hosted by me, Kyle Sconewell, and my longtime friend from work, Robbie Earle. It is the morning after our screening of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. That's one of the best tracks. Love that he brought that back home. Robbie, what did you think of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3? Gut reactions. Ugh, go.
Man, I loved it. It was exactly what I wanted it to be. It was super James Gunn in the best ways. And I think... And not in the ways that I've maybe taken issue with before, that we've taken issue with. It was emotional. Mm-hmm. It was like hilarious. Mm-hmm. It looked great, I thought. The soundtrack was everything that I needed it to be. We're starting to get into like the 90s era of music that is still my comfort zone, my happy place. So I feel like this soundtrack is going to wind up being one of my favorites. Out of three very good soundtracks. I'm very happy. What did you think?
I loved it. My brain is all over the place. So forgive me if this is the most random episode you've ever heard, but I'm just going to start with some things. Okay. Like actual fight sequence to the Beastie Boys song.
Mm-hmm.
That was an all-timer. That was a knee grab moment. Do you know what I mean by that? Like I reached over to Annika and I'm like, pinching her knee going like, this is unbelievable. How long it kept going, how cool it looked, the imagination, the sequence with the music. Holy crap.
Mm-hmm. Man, it's one thing that I loved too about that sequence and just the entire third act of this movie was not a third act in the way that we've come to expect. Like, I think I kept, and this is something that I've liked about all the Guardians films, but I think that, you know, the first one has more of the traditional, here's the team going up against the big villain together moment. And we got bits of that here, but I like that I never knew kind of what the final crescendo would be.
Interesting.
Like it wasn't this like, okay, here we go. And now like big boss battle. I like that there were all those little moments, like little victories that each character had. And it felt fresh, especially within this genre. And so it also felt like little moments like that. I say little moments, but I agree. Like that was one of my big takeaways too. Like that kind of hallway fight was just a chance to highlight these characters and Gunn's style. And it felt pulled from the first film in the best way. Like it just, the whole thing felt, I loved it. It had that spirit of the first film that I think was so initially appealing to people. Like the kind of like anti-establishment kind of a thing, you know, like in terms of what Gunn was trying to do from a storytelling perspective, the boundaries he was willing to push or cross, like it felt fresh in a way that I think is really impressive for a third film that also was such a perfect conclusion to a trilogy. Like, I think that is a really hard balance to achieve, and I think that this movie achieved that.
We talk a lot about how James Gunn, you don't worry about the quality and you don't worry about things feeling shoehorned in or misplaced. Mm-hmm. This is the tiniest detail, but remember when Rocket is being destroyed by the High Evolutionary and he gets thrown to the ceiling in that whatever magnetic pole thing?
Yeah.
Did you catch what happened there? Like, it's so subtle, but yeah, he turns on the gravity boots and then shoots him. And I thought, okay, I think a lot of other directors in movies would have just had Rocket do that. And you as the viewer were supposed to be like, okay, he develops technology. Like, he's got a new thing. That's totally normal. But the fact that we saw that as the first shot in like a throwaway thing, that's like the batteries. Where it's like the batteries still come back to matter. I thought that was so funny. He's good at that stuff.
That was kind of my, I'm glad you say that because I felt like Gunn did that as a whole, like across the whole trilogy in this movie in a way that felt to me really natural.
Yes.
Like even down to like having the guy with the best eyebrows in the business be at the poker table.
Or Peter's grandpa.
Yeah. Yes.
Who he never followed up with again.
And that's what I love here is that it's like there's a respect for these seeds that were planted in the first film. Like he's making sure that he returns to everything. There's nothing left dangling, but it's not in a way that feels like a straight nostalgia play, you know?
Yeah.
I think when he does those, they're kind of few and far between, and that makes them effective. Like whenever he brings Come and Get Your Love Back. In the credits, you know, it's like instead of like, I'm glad that we didn't get just constant callbacks.
Sure.
And that so many of the ones we did were kind of subtle, but effective.
I just said PETA. It makes me think of Hunger Games PETA. You know, I thought PETA's name in Hunger Games was Peter, but they were just saying it with like a Boston accent. PETA! PETA! I meant to say Peter's grandpa, and it kind of turned into PETA's grandpa.
I like that.
No, yes, I love his attention to all those things. And I totally agree that I feel like the temptation there would be to just do constant Guardians 1 shout outs. But yes, when he picked his spots, totally appropriate. Also, am I crazy if I say the following statement? Was this the best looking movie in the MCU visually? It's really close. I've only seen it one time. And the caveat is, I have an incredible IMAX theater here in Nashville that sounded as good and looked as good as I've ever seen a film. I mean, I know there are things in Endgame Infinity War that would probably take issue with that, but holy cow. Let me just rephrase then, not as hot takey. It was one of the best looking movies in the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
I mean, that's what I thought.
Like, their ship was so cool, like how it rotated and spun. Mm-hmm. I thought we got some really unique cinematography with special effects work. Like, this is so dumb. The shot of Gamora in the ship and she's watching Peter drive away in the car. Like, I feel like we haven't gotten so many shots of their perspective from inside the ship and out. Like, the set piece they must have built that is the interior, quote unquote, of the ship. The way they blended that into the effects of the outside, I thought was so cool. I know these are really dumb details, but there was all these things like that I was like, wow, this looks incredible. I said that to Annika maybe 5 times in the middle of the movie.
No, I agree. And I think that's where Gunn really shines as a director is you see it's not, I think often when we're talking about directing here, especially in something like the MCU, We're talking about, you know, a level of quality control. We're talking about a general vibe or genre that someone tends to fall into, like when we talk about the Russo brothers. But I think that one thing about Gunn that I like is that more like Sam Raimi in Multiverse of Madness, it's like you can tell when you're watching a James Gunn film, he wants to get creative with shots, with the way scenes are laid out. And you notice from the opening shot where Rocket's walking through listening to Creep, and the way you're kind of getting an immediate feel for Nowhere without it, like in a way that's still really entertaining and also like kind of sets the table for the movie plot wise and vibe wise. But then the shot you're talking about, some of the shots in the final fight sequences, it's just stuff that looks really cool and is a ton of fun and has this kind of like, James Gunn has managed to keep alive this kind of punk rock aesthetic within the Guardians franchise. And I really love that because I one thing I realized kind of watching these movies back, as much as I love these characters in Infinity War and Endgame, and this is not me saying that I would change that or the way that they appear there, but it's like when Gunn's working with them, it's just different. Like they come to life in different ways. They have different, like he's really tuned into what makes these characters so appealing and what makes this team feel so different. Like in Endgame, there's the temptation, like you see all the heroes lined up and you get the Avengers Assemble moment. And it's like, oh, these are heroes like Spider-Man and like Doctor Strange. And I like that here you realize that they are, it's its own team. They have their own like morality, kind of apart from the average MCU hero.
The slow-mo shots are way more punk rock. By the way, dude, when you found out that Nowhere could move and flew in.
Oh, man.
Let's freaking go. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That was a genuine surprise, and I thought it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, what a cool, yes. Yes!
Man, I...
His imagination, that's, okay, I'm just bouncing all around, but his imagination is next level. And that's what I mean by that. It's not just the high evolutionary creatures, which were super crazy and zany and all these different ideas. It's an idea like that too, that they buy Nowhere. First of all, that's original. Like we haven't thought about that. They set it up as their home base, but with other people that live there. It's now like their own planet, but then they rig it up like a Death Star that it can travel and actually shoot a massive cannon. It's all this stuff, dude. And the new planets we saw and the new, he's very good with the imagination stuff. I've said that from day one. I think it's one of the things that makes Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 really special. And yeah, adds to that different aesthetic that we talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I just said like 10 things, but yes, I love that part of it too.
I did think visually it was just, it popped, but it felt to achieve the kind of color and, like you said, zaniness of the movie as a whole for the most part, but especially some of the scenes, but still have them feel like they have some weight to it, you know, like it's or weight to them. Like it's not, there are parts of other movies that have similar vibes, like parts of Love and Thunder, even Ragnarok, I would say, and like Quantumania, where it's like going for a similar aesthetic, but it doesn't feel as grounded, weirdly. Like I think what Gunn does that's crazy is you don't feel like you're swimming in a green screen ever, even though obviously you are a lot of the time. It's like it feels just like there's an added level of maybe of either craftsmanship or attention or intensity. But I'm curious to hear folks' thoughts there. I went with resident friends from work artist,
yes,
Jacoby Warlick, who who rocked our brand new Guardians of the Galaxy themed Friends from Work shirt.
Let's go.
Which looked excellent. He had the first test pressing and
let's go.
It was great. It was great. But he pointed out to me a few things that, and it's always interesting talking to him from the animation perspective, because I think he's really attuned to when things are well animated and well constructed,
sure,
and when they're not. Like, I think he maybe spots little telltale signs that I wouldn't think of. And he said that there were a few moments that he thought did not look good. Like, he talked about like the kind of like fleshy door sequences when they're going in. Like, he said he thought some of that was off. He thought he noticed some of the character model stuff. I didn't notice any of that, but I'm also kind of known as the person that doesn't notice those things. But generally, I mean, I say all that, he and I both loved it. So it's not as though we came out nitpicking.
The only time I felt that was maybe that sequence from the trailer when they're actually taking the spacesuits down to the fleshy part. Like, I felt like maybe I could tell that it was like a green screen shift there, but no, overall, I thought it looked amazing.
The soundtrack.
Okay.
Was perfect.
Not as good as the other ones.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Here we go. Wow. Here we go.
See, I'm torn there because I think you would say that we're looking at like a Guardians 1 score, Guardians 2 score, and what, Guardians 3 score? Like a little starting at the top of the pyramid and sliding down.
Oh.
Or sorry, soundtrack. Soundtrack.
Yeah, okay. Not score.
Not score. Yeah. I want to get into score in a second.
Yes. Yep. I think I have a slight soft spot for the oldies, like true oldies, first of all.
Mm.
And secondly, I just don't know on one viewing, that the songs all felt as appropriately placed to me. Like, emotionally, I don't know that I had the same impact each time it came on. That being said, it's one viewing. I reserve the right to change my mind on that, but I didn't leave feeling like it had as much impact.
See, I came in with mixed feelings, knowing he was going to hit some 90s stuff, because I feel like we have now just really drained the well that is the 90s nostalgia dry. And so I was like, I mean even the MCU has done that with Captain Marvel, and since then I remember when that came out, which was 2019, I was already thinking, okay, I think we've done the 90s thing
a lot,
maybe to death. But and then that was 4 years ago, right? So now I was like, oh man. And you know, because culture, this is a whole nother conversation, and he sort of previews this as well. But I mean, culturally, we're past recycled 90s and into recycled 2000s.
Yes.
And you're seeing that up in both music and movies and TV. But
we're getting so old.
I know. But that said, I really loved the Radiohead pick. Mm-hmm. I loved,
so did I.
Like a lot of the songs that he picked are just songs that I didn't even really recognize, which I kind of loved.
Deeper cuts.
That's what I liked about some of even the, like, I had never heard Hooked on a Feeling before Guardians Volume 1.
Oh, I have.
Like, that was a song that I just, but I'm, see, this is the thing with you and me. I don't think, I'm not a huge oldies guy. Like, I grew up with a specific set of things. Like, my mom listened to a ton of Billy Joel, James Taylor, and, like, some Michael Jackson, but really, like, I didn't grow up listening to a lot of the stuff that shows up. Like, I'm familiar, obviously, with a lot of the stuff on the Guardians 1 soundtrack when it comes to, like, Come Get Your Love and Cherry Bomb and all that.
I think the more you get into music and the more you get into playing, specifically, like, the musicians and the producing side of it, the more I learn about how easy it is to produce now, I gain a respect for what people were able to pull off in the 60s when they didn't have any of these things. Like, some of the players on this stuff, like, go listen to the bass player on some of those Motown tracks from the first movie. Mm-hmm. It's like, holy crap, this guy is just shredding and nobody knows or cares. But like, he's doing this in one take, Rob, with no edits.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Anyway, so I have a respect for him on that front as well.
I wanted to ask this while this is not at all related to Guardians, but have you seen the movie Love and Mercy?
No.
It is a Paul Dano, John Cusack movie about Brian Wilson.
Okay.
And so it's sort of a, like, there's a lot of Pet Sounds stuff, unsurprisingly, and nice. Him in the studio producing that and how they're coming up with certain sounds. And that's, I thought about that because it's such a, I feel like the movie really tries to highlight how, one, like how innovative that album was, but also like what it took for them to get the sounds that they got. That album is one of the most perfect ever, by the way.
I need to, woo, woo. But yes, I need to see that film. I just need to clarify on the soundtrack front. I still really liked it. I'm just saying if I had to compare, it's, you know, it's the third for me. How did you feel about the score itself? Which I actually thought was better than I thought it was going to be. I felt like it actually exceeded my expectations. Oh, really? Okay. But again, I'm in an incredible IMAX theater with like booming sound. So maybe that's part of it.
Well, okay. So I want to say a couple things. One, to wrap up the soundtrack side, I think I see a bit of what you're saying with some of the placements themselves. I think I'm going to enjoy the soundtrack as just a listening experience. I think that there were certain times, and I've noticed this in past Gunn films as well, that it's like when he hits, it hits so hard and it works so well. And then sometimes it's not a miss. Like, I don't think that there's ever a problem where we've talked about certain films where it just really is jarring. Like the song choice, it just doesn't, not only does it not enhance the scene, it detracts from the scene. Mm-hmm. I never get that sense here, but I think that because he set the bar so high, like I think pretty much every song placement in Guardians 1 feels right. Like it feels locked in.
Yes.
I think there are maybe a few in both Guardians 2 and Guardians 3 that don't, like that feels looser.
Yeah.
But I do love all of the song choices themselves, and most of the placements I thought were perfect. But yes, on the score, I think this is what I was hoping we would get in Love and Thunder. Like,
you're opening that up again. Hey, you're contractually obligated to bring up Love and Thunder whenever possible.
Right?
So thank you.
Listen, I've been listening to the Love and Thunder score a lot because the vinyl finally came in. And
Mama's got a brand new hammer. Slaps, dude, makes me cry every time I listen to it.
So here's the thing, because I'm glad you brought that up. The score is excellent. Michael Giacchino, when you spend any amount of time with his scores, I mean, he doesn't do bad work. There are a lot of moments that I don't even think I've noticed before because I kind of listen to certain key tracks. But one thing that I still wish that Giacchino had done is like take that theme that he uses for Jane that he uses in general in Thor for Jane. Like he writes a new theme and we have a new Thor. And I feel like there was a way where he could have used that theme really just as much and to just as great effect when it comes to Jane, and then kept the themes from Thor that had kind of been integrated so well in Ragnarok via Mother's Ba, where it's like, then you could still get some of those emotional callback moments while still allowing Giacchino to play around and do new things. That's what I thought we got here, where I was so happy the first time I heard Murphy reference back to the Bates Guardians theme and to like the We Are Groot theme from the first film. Like, but I thought he also added, you know, like it was a different, it didn't feel like he was just a cover band for Tyler Bates. Like it felt like he was adding some new things, but I thought that he went back as appropriate.
I think I totally agree. I was pleasantly surprised like towards the very beginning of the movie. And again, my memory is a little foggy right now, but they actually basically recreate the whole Black Tears thing. Sorry. They do that theme, but they recreate the Into the Stars version of it where it's like the chill emotional version, but like pretty much chord for chord, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I really appreciate that. I think I got more of that than I even, like we were nervous about that. And then I got more of it than I thought. And I totally agree. I like most of the other like dark stuff that he did for all the other themes. Mm-hmm. A little bit easy on the guitar, like easy on the electric guitar, these people. Okay. Like it became a thing again, but I still loved it.
That's
let me put it this way.
Danny Elfman, man.
Let me put it this way. I had concerns and I have no reason to have had those concerns. Like Tyler Bates to now John Murphy, I mean this in a good way, was pretty much like a wash, like an even trade. Like I don't feel like it was a step down.
Again, having just watched the first two, I was struck by how great Bates's themes are. I don't know that like scene for scene, the score in the first two Guardians films is that memorable or noticeable in part because of how large the soundtrack, you know, how significant the soundtrack is for all these movies. But I felt like in the, you know, it's like whenever he needs to show up with a theme, like with Black Tears, especially, it really hits. But I think in some of the kind of quiet in between moments, there's not a lot that's being added. And I did feel like Murphy did a better job of that. Like I feel like it just felt fuller to me. Mm. Part of me almost wonders if, you know, and I need to rewatch it too, but in some ways I think it was a bit of an improvement as a whole. I just think it is hard for me to ever get past how great the dad song is in Guardians Volume 2. But aside from that, I felt good about it. Definitely more so than I would have thought, because we kind of talked about how, you know, I had found past scores of Murphy's to be a bit forgettable.
Let's get into a few specific plot things after a quick word from these sponsors. And we are super pumped to be partnering with Epic Hero Shop again, who has now rebranded Robbie as Nerd Riot. Nerdriot.shop. Okay. And if you like this shirt I'm wearing, people who are watching on YouTube or Spotify, this is another Nerd Riot classic Miss Marvel shirt. But we have some brand new Guardians of the Galaxy theme shirts coming too, which didn't make it in time, but I will be wearing on multiple episodes coming up that I'm super pumped about. They actually took famous like rock band covers, like album covers, and then edited Guardians into them. So like the famous Nirvana cover of the Naked Baby now Groot, a Star-Lord shot. But yeah, I'm excited to be partnering with them again. They're awesome. And you're going to hear us talking about them a lot in the coming weeks. What shirts did you pick out, by the way?
So I got the Ziggy Star-Lord, Bowie inspired shirt. And then I also got the Dark Side of the Galaxy shirt, the Pink Floyd shout out. Yeah, yeah. This was probably my favorite drop so far from those folks. Like I was looking through and I genuinely had to kind of select, like I still wound up picking two. And I had to narrow that down a bit because I just already own way too many t-shirts and now I own two more.
Something that legitimately warmed my heart. I'm exiting the theater. The guy next to me wearing a Trust a Bro shirt. And I was like, yes, let's go.
Excellent.
Seriously, go to nerdriot.shop. Use our promo code FRIENDSFROMWORK to save 15%. Even if you've used a code in the past, it now works again. So FRIENDSFROMWORK, 15% off any of their products at nerdriot.shop. Check them out. I want to say that I was actually genuinely shocked that nobody died of the main characters.
Yes. So if we had to do a
where Robbie was right, where Kyle was right, and where Kyle was wrong, I was way wrong on that. Like I predicted that half, if not more, would die. And then for the last 12 hours, I've been wrestling with that. I think I like that none of them died. But I need more time with that because I think I was so prepared that they were going to, which maybe that's the reason I like it. That's the smart call, is that there was so much hints at Rocket dying, Quill dying, and even false alarms, like times where they like basically did die.
Well, and in the trailer, you know, they really like, I noticed the first time I was like, okay, I think we might be getting, we might have kind of gotten Joss Whedon'd here with the death fake out, was when the scene that's kind of pitched as very emotional in the trailer of them walking out carrying,
right,
you know, an unconscious Quill is actually just them carrying him drunk out of the bar.
Right.
Which is not, still not played for laughs. Like in the moment, it's still seen as kind of as heavy, but not in like a, you know, Quill's about to die kind of way.
Totally red herring dust a little bit there. Did you ultimately, because we talk about death in this podcast a lot. At first, yeah, for the first.
Just in general, not,
yeah,
not,
just, yeah, right,
not
right,
within the context of movies.
Just, hey, have you heard about anyone dying today? Let's hear about
it.
Yeah,
the next spinoff, Friends from Work podcast, is just death, reading obituaries.
Friends from Death. In our first two phases, I would say, we often in our rewatch episodes complained about how the Marvel Cinematic Universe has not handled death very well. Really, if you go back, because it's such a building phase, you lose like Thor's mother and Agent Coulson. It's very few and far between, though. Then there's kind of a phase with like Ragnarok, Infinity War, Endgame, and then in phase four where we lost lots of people, or at least we reflected on lots of different characters being gone or lost or whatever. But now I wonder if our mindset as a podcast has actually shifted a little bit towards, you know, you can't just use death as your get out of jail free card anytime you don't have a good story. And so I think I'm wrestling with this. I think that's why I ultimately like nobody dying, because it feels like it was so obviously set up that someone has to. So then when they actually left those pieces on the board, I'm like, oh
yeah,
maybe that was what we said. Like maybe he favored a good story over a death being the trope, I guess. I don't know. I'm wrestling with it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've thought that too. In part, I think the reason why we raised that issue is because so many of those early MCU films did follow a formula more so than some of the later ones have. And I think that that's actually appropriate because they were kind of getting the playbook out and figuring out what worked and what didn't work. And I think that's what made phase three so strong, is we had kind of had all this lead in time with these characters, with the way Marvel tells stories. And then they were able to start getting creative and culminating in Infinity War and Endgame. But I think from the get-go, Gunn has kind of avoided that formula. Like that's one of the things that I was really struck by watching Guardians 2, especially. Like he really doesn't use the same three-act structure that I've come to expect from Marvel films, which means that those moments in, like, you know, if we take the first like two Thor movies, where it's like the moments where we're getting faked out, like, oh no, is Thor going to die? And then he doesn't die. And Loki does die, but he actually doesn't die. And you're like, okay, I feel like there are never any stakes because people just always either come back or like at the very last moment are able to save the day. We don't have those problems really ever in the Guardians franchise because in the very first film, we lose Peter's mom, but then Groot in a really moving way. And then in the second film, you know, we lose Yondu in a really moving way. And so I think that because those are the ones that even in the period where I think we had thought maybe Marvel needs to be more comfortable with adding some weight, with letting some characters go. Like I think in that period, Gunn was one of the only creators that I thought was really handling that particular side of it well. And so now I kind of, you know, when we are in a phase where we look back, we've lost more characters in, you know, certainly in Infinity War and Endgame, but also in phase four than we would have in prior films, you know, with Jane in Love and Thunder, obviously with T'Challa in Wakanda Forever. And I feel like there are a lot of, or more examples, more recently at least. And so I like that Gunn now is still doing his own thing, But I think what I love the most about it is kind of what you were saying at the start, which is, like, when I think about the most emotional moments for me in the MCU, especially recently, they are, one, Aunt May's death in No Way Home, and two, Jane's death in Love and Thunder. And those are both beautiful scenes, both some of my favorite scenes in those movies and in the kind of post-Endgame MCU. But to your point, that is a bit of a layup when it comes to getting an emotional reaction from the audience. Now, it still needs to be executed well, and that's what sets those apart. But that's kind of like, hey, I want to get my audience emotionally invested. I want to make them tear up a little bit. Like, we're going to kill off an important character. I mean, Gunn got emotional reactions out of me all through that movie.
True.
And yes, some of them were around, is a character going to die or a character that is seemingly on their deathbed. But a lot of them weren't. Like, and that's what, like, the final sequence really, I mean, the final battle itself, but then also kind of the dance scene, Guardians send off at the very end, like, that got me in a way that I felt so earned. And that's what I loved about it. Like, it was like this just love for the characters that Gunn, so, like, he, that so clearly shines through. It's like in no way manufactured. It's not cynical. Like, it's just a really, again, like a really fresh way of, like, pulling at the heartstrings that I think is way harder to pull off. And I thought worked so, so well for me.
Okay. I agree. Here we go. I really agree. I felt like there were just like three or four tiny, tiny little things where at the very end, I wondered if it was like a step too far in trying to make sure that everyone got what they wanted. I guess let me just say specifics and then you tell me if you think I'm just like way off base.
Yeah.
I think this is why I liked the Gamora decision. Like, the way they handled Gamora, I think I really liked, because I liked they didn't get back together. I like that instead it's challenging Peter that he has to grow, go back to Earth, like find something in himself to move on. But I do love that Gamora had that little interchange back to back where she said, like, were we fun? And he's like, you have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, I have chills right now. Like, her acknowledging that. I saw some people on our Discord maybe not loving that part.
Like that scene in particular?
Well, just that Gamora, like, ends the film while the Guardians are hugging and having a dance party. She's doing it with the Ravagers, and that just feels weird because she's not a Ravager. She's a Guardian. But I think, ultimately, that's the kind of thing I liked. I liked there being a little bit of dissonance there. So my specific instances are, like, again, I could be totally crazy. When Groot said, I love you guys, our theater gasped. And I looked at Annika and said, should they have done that? That's exactly what I said. Oh, should they have done that? I didn't know. Oh, I don't know if they should do that.
Can I ask you a question, though?
Yeah, please.
And I truly don't know. I don't know the answer to this. And this is maybe an example of me reading into something. But I took that to be, you know, you have that one scene where she's like, y'all are just making stuff up, right? Like, making things up that he's saying. Like, you can't actually understand
it. Oh, that we now heard it?
Yes. Like, because you have the moment of recognition from Gamora where he says, I am Groot. And she's like, oh, I thought that it was kind of this, like, now in the very end, like, we can also speak Groot. Like, we've now spent this time with the...
I had never thought of that. If that is the true interpretation of the scene, or if that was his intention... That's way better. I think that's way better. You're right. In that way, yeah, that would be like a hug from him to the audience that now, yes, you've grown so much that you can speak Groot. Okay, if that's the explanation, great. Let me just do a few rapid fire, though.
I just wanted to say on that, too, it would also link back to the kind of We Are Groot moment in Guardians 1 in that it's an inclusive thing. And that feels very gun to me. So it doesn't feel like that crazy of a reach, okay. But I think I'm probably just going to interpret it that way regardless.
And okay, I have to give this disclaimer. I loved it. I should probably start with this. It's in my top 10. So now we're talking amongst tier one films. When I ask these questions, these are not even takes. These are more me just thoughts and I'm wrestling with it thing. And even if I don't like this tiny, tiny little thing, overall, it was executed so well and I was so moved emotionally that I'm okay with these things. But I'm just bringing them up now. So that's my disclaimer. I do like it. Don't get me wrong. The one line from Nebula at the very end where she says, like, Drax, you showed me a lot today, and I learned something new about you. It was something like that, and again, one viewing, where I was like, okay, I remember in the moment I thought, did that need to be said, Jim Halpert? Did that really need to be said? Like, I think the audience already inferred that she was growing an appreciation for what Drax does bring to the table after that being a plot throughout, that I didn't think I needed her to like kind of come out of character and so soften that she like just so eloquently says that to him.
Yeah, I think what I with that first statement itself, I can see what you're saying. Like, it may be an example of telling instead of showing.
Yes.
I think that the two things that redeem that, I mean, to the extent it needs to be redeemed, but the two things I like about that, I guess, are one, she now is kind of like the way that she's grown, not just because of the events of Infinity War and Endgame, but also like, you know, looking back in Volume 2 when she and Gamora are talking, and again, a Gamora that she has now lost, despite the fact that there is a Gamora back. Like, one of the last things that Gamora said to her was, there, you know, girls, little girls like us all across the galaxy that need saving. Like, you can join us and help. And she says, now I will save them by killing Thanos. And then we kind of know how all that goes. But I love that now, like, as she's wanting to lead the city, and part of that is leading all of these girls that they've saved, which feels like
And I like that as a plot. Like, overall, I like the plot of her.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I'm not,
I'm just saying the line specifically of, like, Drax, but you taught me a lot today.
But I think that's why I'm okay with kind of the more, the tenderness there, because I feel like she's coming out of this experience now, and they're all kind of reflective. The other thing, though, that I really like, apart from that opening line, I do like the "you were never meant to be a destroyer, you were meant to be a dad" line.
Sure. Yep.
Because of how much it takes us back to the initial introduction of Drax. You know, like, I think we had, because you and I have talked a lot about how are they going to handle Drax. I was, you know, watching the first two installments again and thinking about Batista saying that, you know, Drax gets his ass kicked more than any other character. And I was surprised that rather than try to correct for that, they almost just leaned into it and then came out the other side. Like, it's like, instead of trying to backtrack and make Drax actually like
super serious or all powerful or any of that stuff,
they like, you still get some really good moments of like Drax being the one that can open the door, and like in the fight scene, he's got some great moves with his dagger that I liked. But yeah, ultimately it's like, this isn't actually what we love about the character anyway. Like, we don't need another super badass strong character. Maybe, like, maybe what we love about Drax is that his motivation has always been like to avenge his wife and his daughter that he loved so much. And then, so to like kind of see that part of him come out, like, that's what I want to hear more thoughts before we like go way down each character rabbit trail. But that's why I was okay with the way that they did these send-offs, because that shows me, okay, Drax is is out there. If we ever need to do some kind of massive assemble everybody, I'm sure that, I mean, it would not be strange for him to show up.
Nope.
But it feels like a very, if we never see Drax again, that wouldn't feel weird either. Because now it's like, okay, I think I like that these characters, just because they're kind of superheroes, are not going to always be just superheroing. Like the idea that they will go and move to another phase of their life.
I do too. I have nothing to argue with that. This is like the dumb, like, this is such
a small line, though.
And well, here's the smallest detail possible. Like, I like Drax dancing at the end, but I just wonder, would the Drax I know go full blown like jumping dancing? Like I think I anticipate him doing like a subtle, and that was his way of getting into it. And that shot just got me thinking. I a little bit wonder if we got a tiny bit sidetracked in the sending off of these actors and the fact that they're a family behind the scenes, which is totally appropriate and I love. But it became like a little bit focused on, wow, this is over as far as James Gunn directing these actors. And it a little bit pulled certain characters out of like the character's actual response. Like the I am Groot line, did that pull Groot a little bit? The Nebula miswriting of a couple like tender lines, did that feel like Nebula? And the way Drax even danced, did that feel like Drax? Or are we saying, thank you, Dave Bautista, for such a journey? Do you see what I'm saying?
I
loved it. I love the send-off. I love that you're right, that they're not just out there ready to go. I love Quill going back to Earth, Mantis saying she needs some time away, all that. I'm just saying tiny details. I don't know.
Yeah. I think, you know, one thing that I really liked about that final scene, something that I think I had wanted in Endgame that I didn't get, and I think was, you know, probably necessary with the way that very, you know, they had a lot of dots to connect there to make that plot work. But I think I was always hoping for a moment where you had like the original six Avengers kind of in that, like,
sure.
Even like, it doesn't have to be a straight callback to them in a circle, which we do get that in game of the original Avengers. But one thing that I would have liked in Endgame is something that felt a bit more like a send-off with those characters. And I think because the plot didn't give that particular moment in the same way, I think that's why we get that at the end of Endgame, the credits and the original six kind of get that moment.
Sure.
This final scene here gave me that in a way that maybe is a little meta. We all know this is James Gunn's last film here. It's the last Guardians film that will at least look like what we've known the Guardians to look like. So it is hard for me to figure out how much of that I'm bringing in. But I'm impressed by how fitting each of those journeys felt to me, you know, both in kind of where they wound up and then, you know, the sense of where we think they're going. I'm super intrigued to see what happens with Peter.
Well, I was really surprised with all of the marketing being one last ride, one trip into the forever unknown, all this stuff that, you know, we talked about. I was surprised that nobody died. But then I was even more surprised that they actually would go out of their way to say Star-Lord will return, because there was so much off-screen talk about how this is their last trip and it will never be the same without James. And I get it. It won't be. But I don't know if that's Marvel stepping in and saying like, hey, we would like Star-Lord around. Don't kill him. Keep it possible. I don't know if Chris Pratt was like, I would still like to be a part of this if we could, or if James just like, the best story is that he's still out there and can come back. I love it. I love it. I want him around, but I was surprised.
I love it, man. I love it too. And a big part of it is I just, I think this is the best version of Chris Pratt. Mm-hmm. The Star-Lord character is so clearly modeled around him and around his own sensibilities.
Oh, and some serious heartfelt moments and some really funny moments from him.
Oh, like it felt like the we've talked about this. You and I talked briefly last night, and the first thing you said was, I bet you loved the Star-Lord version we got here. And I did, because it's still messy. Like, he's always kind of been a messy character, mm-hmm. but he's funny, he's confident, and he's capable. And
cool.
Man, it just, they nailed that balance so well here, to the point where I want to spend more time with this version of Star-Lord. And it's something that I think other franchises that have utilized Pratt have failed to do. Like, if you go back and watch Parks and Rec, one, his comedic timing is
off the
insane.
Charts. Yeah.
And it's so, like, he's so lovable. There's like a lovability factor to Chris Pratt if he's given the right role. And I don't know why. I guess I do know why. This is what happens with a lot of these folks, but it's like, because I would say the same thing about Hemsworth. And apart from the Thor movies, Hemsworth has often been shoehorned into just tough guy action roles. And that's also the role that Pratt has been given, to where I'm like, man, I watch him in like the Jurassic World films. And mm-hmm. it's not that he's doing a bad job. It's just that I don't connect to him at all or really care about him in those movies the way that I do when he's portraying this character. And I want, because I think I want more of that from Pratt, I want more of this character.
Yeah, I think specifically his comments about Rocket being his best friend, those were huge emotional drivers for me. Like, those were some of the most moving moments. And I loved the explanation of Infinity War and Endgame and him losing his cool in Infinity War to Gamora. Like, that was funny. And him like charming that like assistant, you know, at mm-hmm. that place. Like, cool. Swaggery. It was working. Yeah. He has a plan. He had a plan when he saw the High Evolutionary. Yes, it's not a mm-hmm. goofy, like, butt of the joke Star-Lord. It's a Han Solo character. Yeah. So I love it.
The moment. Yeah, like Groot having the guns hidden.
Yes.
Like, it feels
that was so sick.
It's that's the thing. I don't think that we got so much of that in Guardians 1, which I loved. And we didn't really get any of that in Guardians 2, because so much of it is Peter kind of on his back foot trying to figure out what's going on. And and because just the villain there doesn't lend itself as much to like the kind of heisty type stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I think what I loved, we saw why Star-Lord was the leader of the Guardians, like why that has been that character's role. Whereas like mm-hmm. over the past couple films and appearances, it's sort of like, what is he actually bringing to this team? Like, and I'm not to over-exaggerate. I just mean, there are times where they show up being just, they're all kind of funny in their own ways, and they're just a bunch of goofballs. And I like that we see, okay, part of his role here is that he's good at what he does. Like, he was like a master thief, you know, and, mm-hmm. and he knows, like, even when we're seeing him get through the shields,
yes.
like just little things of like, he knows what he's doing. And I like that a lot. Oh. I think it was refreshing.
No doubt. I loved it.
I am genuinely interested from a character perspective where Star-Lord's going to go, though.
Yeah.
Because
is he going to be involved in Secret Wars?
I bet. I mean,
I think so,
I would
too.
Think, yeah. I mean, it's, man, I'm just, I'm curious to see what that even looks like. Like, how you have a Star-Lord that's not in space.
Okay, so just as a total guess, I would say it felt like they are taking Drax and Mantis off the board. Would you agree? That basically, like, you'll check in with them maybe just via a sentence or a line, or maybe you'll see them, but also given the off-screen stuff with Dave Bautista, like, it feels like they were removed from the story. It feels like they left the door more open for Rocket than I ever thought they would.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, the post-credit scene.
Yeah.
You could maybe interpret that as, hey, he's just going to be doing that. But because Adam Warlock's going to be involved,
yeah,
I don't think they would include him in that if they weren't showing us that, like, Rocket might be around for something. And I think Quill will be around for something. Unsure on Nebula, I think they could easily just say she's retired to that planet and she's looking out after people, and that's the end of her character. Actually, that's probably where I'm leading.
I agree. I tend to think that Drax is basically off the table. I mean, who knows? If something comes along where they really want that character, I'm sure that they would be able to motivate Bautista to come back. But it feels like that's Mantis. I'm not totally sure. And the reason I say that is
comic stuff.
Yeah, like we've talked about the big, like, Celestial Madonna story from back in the day, and how Mantis in more recent years, Marvel Comics has kind of brought that character back in that way, probably because of her prominence within the MCU. But I think the fact that she kind of goes off from such a place of power here makes me wonder if we're going to circle back around and see her in a totally different role. You mentioned Adam Warlock, and I think it's funny how so much of the Infinity Saga, as we've talked about, was based in attempting to be, especially the early stuff, kind of grounded. And then even the version of Thanos that we got is a much more, like, rather than him being this cosmic being that's in love with the personification of death.
Sure.
You know, he
like we
is.
Are.
Right, right. I mean, friends from death. But he is more of a kind of, he's philosophically motivated. He's more thoughtful. He's smart. He's, you know, he's not just like a twirling your mustache kind of villain.
Right.
Like he can be in the comics. Parts of phase four, and really more phase five almost, between this and Quantumania, is we're seeing the MCU start to set up some of the more classic Marvel cosmic stuff, like the stuff that I think is arguably harder to adapt. And that's why I'm so fascinated to see, like, they're setting some of the Kang stuff, even that they're setting up, is from eras of Marvel Comics that are just more complicated, a little bit more convoluted, and not written by writers that were in the habit of writing screenplay style scripts.
Interesting.
So you get, like, you look back at some of the Roy Thomas stuff, but also the Jim Starlin stuff that we'll kind of get into here in a second, more with Adam Warlock. But it's all very, it's like grand and like operatic and weird and not grounded really in any way. Like it's very high concept. And so I'm just thinking about the version of Mantis that I think shows up there. I'm thinking about kind of the role that Adam Warlock has played. And I wonder if Marvel's going to kind of run with what Gunn has provided them and lean into some of that and do more trippy cosmic stuff, or if this is them doing that. And I think the answer to that question will determine whether we see much more of a character like Mantis.
Hmm.
The comics that they pulled from in this movie are some that I have actually not, I hadn't either hadn't read or hadn't read in forever.
Mm.
There, you know, I noticed the creators that they thank, which I always find interesting to kind of see which yes. comics creators the movie feels that they pulled from. I saw like Donnie Cates, who wrote a recent Guardians run, showed up. I don't know if I saw the Al Ewing run get a shout out, although I think this book that just came out, you know, kind of in coordination with the film, is a collection of the Al Ewing Guardians comics. And I do think still, having finished the movie, that kind of captured the vibe. If you want to read a modern Guardian series that kind of has that like core family, but funny and kind of high concept at times and trippy, I think this is like a recognizable set of characters while also introducing, it's a good way to get to know a lot of the other space-based cosmic Marvel characters if we are actually heading in the direction. And modern comics are just generally easier to read, quicker to read. There are not like Stan Lee-style text boxes across an entire page. But what I also wanted to talk about is this Adam Warlock like tome.
Oh, hello.
That I also got sent from our friends at Organic Priced Books.
Yeah.
Both of these are for sale, by the way, and they're both on sale for like a crazy kind of unbeatable price right now.
Yes.
So if you go to Organic Priced Books, now you can find them. This is an especially fun one, I think, if people were intrigued by the character of Adam Warlock or the character of the High Evolutionary. Mm. And there's a lot of those characters intertwine much more in the comics than they even did in the film. But you can read a few key issues in here and get a really good sense of what Gunn was pulling. Specifically, the idea of Adam Warlock kind of as an all-powerful newborn. And some of, like, I really love the way that Will Poulter did that, and we'll talk about that in a second. But they're pulling from a lot of the Roy Thomas and Jim Starlin, Adam Warlock, like, original stuff. And even those are very different takes. But you get, if you want to read Adam Warlock stuff, I think this is where you start. And the beauty of collections like this is you don't have to figure out, like, several of these are from comics that are not called Adam Warlock. So it's not like an easy search. They've pulled all of the stuff together chronologically and curated it. Mm. There's also a little forward in here written by Douglas Wolk, friend of the pod.
Let's go.
So a ton of fun. Also just like classic Gil Kane, Jim Starlin art. So if you are interested in these characters and in Guardians kind of cosmic Marvel comics, I think these are great books to get. And if you go to Organic Press Books right now and do code Friends From Work, enter code Friends From Work, you will get a couple of extra bucks off of that order.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have some really great, really nice looking comics on your shelf.
The fact remains the same. If you are into buying comics like that, you're not going to find a better price, a more pristinely packed product than at organicpricebooks.com. So go there. You can click on our referral link in the show notes, or like Robbie said, go to organicpricebooks.com and use our promo code Friends From Work. We'll be right back after a quick word from these sponsors. I love that you brought up Adam Warlock, because I wanted to talk about that. As someone who knows nothing about Adam Warlock, as recently as 3 weeks ago, I asked you if he was a villain or if he's a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of loved this portrayal. I have no idea if people are upset that he's kind of a young born like person in this, but I thought it was really funny. And if you want to get away from this, it will be really easy, right? Because you could just the next chapter be like, oh, he's grown up. He's growing up fast, like Groot, and he's evolved. So I thought this was a really fun entry. He ended up not being as main of a character as I thought, but I thought how it was handled, and like Captain Marvel to Endgame, I liked that the movie still put the focus on the original Guardians more than Adam Warlock. But I'm excited to see what he could do in the future. And I thought it was funny, really funny. The disintegration of that guy was so funny. Yeah. Like just lots of good parts, I thought. So for me, that was a huge win.
Yeah. I don't know how I could have shown him anymore.
Yeah.
How much we mean business.
Yeah. How much we mean. That's what it was. I wish I could remember more of the jokes across the board, because Again, I just watched it one time, didn't take notes, but I laughed so hard. Now I'm blanking on what some of those parts were.
It's always interesting to see what the kind of comics fan internet reaction is to any adaptation. This is one that I would not be surprised, because there are a lot of people that really love those classic comics I was talking about. But I don't think that I would really buy a legitimate pushback here, because I think that Gunn did a great job of showing that he's familiar with the character's roots. It didn't feel like he was being dismissive of the source material. It felt like he was pulling out some of the more interesting parts of that character and focusing on those. Like there are lines from those old comics where they talk about how he is, like, he's been birthed in this kind of cocoon pod, and he comes out earlier than intended, and he's kind of learning what life is, and like having all these interactions that are almost, it almost feels like fable-esque, where it's like he's learning these different life lessons.
That's what this was.
Yeah, like I think it was the way that they root it in the Sovereign, I really liked. That made sense to me, the way that then the Sovereign are a part of the High Evolutionaries experiments, I really liked, in terms of just, again, making all three of these movies feel like everything had its place. You know, nothing was random or extraneous. And so that connection I liked. Like I said, Adam Warlock and the High Evolutionary have a connection to the comics, so that also makes sense. But I think the biggest thing for me is Adam Warlock, like I think you said, there's a way to interpret that character that comes out pretty similar to Vision, even to the point where in the comics, the stone, like the gem that's on his head, is an Infinity Stone.
Right.
And so I think that the way that Gunn interpreted it is, one, still true to the comics, but allows Will Poulter to do a very different kind of thing than what Paul Bettany was doing with Vision, especially in like Age of Ultron.
Yeah.
It's like a much more, it's funny. Like it I think plays to Will Poulter's strength. The movies that I've seen where he gets to do the comedy thing, I think are the most memorable for me when it comes to his role in them. Like I think that he has really great sensibilities there. And I thought it was a great addition. And I think I connected more with that portrayal than I maybe even expected going into it. What did you think?
I loved it. Like I said, I thought it was hilarious. Weird, because it was predictable in that, like, I knew he was going to catch Peter at the end. And I, before this, in our Burning Questions episode, predicted that he would, like, see the ways of the Guardians and decide, like, oh, I don't want to actually kill them, and then eventually join them, which is exactly what I guessed. But it didn't take away from my enjoyment of it. But again, I did like that they didn't make that or him the focal point of the film.
One thing that I felt a bit, because I really liked the kind of humanization of Aisha and the added context with the Sovereign, and even the line where the High Evolutionary is like, you know, you were more an aesthetic experiment and you've let your egos run away with themselves, which is also a nice, like, dude, I'm all of the, like, that ego line. And then the fact that they showed up, like, the last time, like, their big defeat was because they went to Ego's planet. Like, there are just a lot of, layers to a lot of the stuff. But, one thing that it was a beat that I really liked, the moment of him losing his mother because of the High Evolutionary, that I felt was not built out all the way. Like, we see him going to try to get her and save her and then failing. And I don't think we ever really see his reaction to that after that one moment, do we?
Well, you see him really beat up and really distraught. I think I bought it. I mean, he flies back to the ship and he barely makes it back to the ship from the explosion, and his like, you know, attire is all ripped off and whatnot.
Yeah.
And then a couple times you see him kind of mourning the loss of his mother. Yeah, I think so.
I guess maybe that final scene, that like look at the Guardians, is maybe even kind of a, like, maybe that's baked into that too.
What did you think of the High Evolutionary in general?
Oh, excellent, I thought. I thought the best villain of the Guardians franchise.
I like how powerful they made him. And I'm going to steer this to the next thing that I freaking loved. I have to give this disclaimer a lot. I am not like a gore fest guy. Like, I don't like gore. I don't like horror movies, all that stuff. But we now have a spectrum. In the MCU, in the action sequences, you have, on one hand, Black Panther, where not a single punch feels like it really hit somebody. The set piece feels small and like claustrophobic for some reason. And none of the stakes really feel that real because you just don't see any ramifications, which, by the way, I actually felt more on a second rewatch of Wakanda Forever as well.
Oh, interesting.
And then you have this on the other side of it, which is, this is by far the darkest, the most edgy, there's an F word in it, gory, like almost no punches are pulled. This is the closest thing to Suicide Squad that he's ever had. In the MCU, I give you tons of details, but even the way the High Evolutionary's face gets mauled by Rocket is grotesque.
Yeah.
But then, like, here's a tiny detail. When they peel the skin off, there's like a little like juicy blood strand that gets stuck still. That sequence I referenced earlier during the Beastie Boys song, I mean, there's actual gore there. There's a knife through a guy's leg and he's screaming. Tons of edge in the brutality department, which I found, it's weird because I don't want it all the time, but it does really help ground the film. Like, all of a sudden, even though nobody died, I do feel stakes because I'm seeing how awful it is. Even the rocket torture stuff, like you're seeing how awful it is, even though no one's dying. So you feel it, it feels heavier. And I felt like it was really appropriate to the movie. It helped move the emotional needle as well. So I think if they had taken a lesser approach to it, I would have felt a little let down, even though I'm not obsessed with gore.
I see that. I think also just from a plot perspective, like not just the actual execution of those moments, but even like what I was saying earlier about the Guardians being a separate kind of team within the MCU, like the fact that Peter like grabs that guy and like grinds him into the ground basically and kills him. And I thought for a moment when he's like pulling something out that he was going to be doing some kind of med pack thing to save the guy's life, but he's actually just digging the chip out.
Yeah. Like, how about Adam Warlock ripping off that guy's head, the pig head?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Like there was a lot of that. Like, that's what I'm saying.
One of the things that I laughed at loudest was when they're walking in and like breaking into the facility to get the data on Rocket, and the woman's like, "Okay, look, we don't want any trouble," and Gamora just immediately shoots her in the leg.
Yes,
the timing of that.
Yes, and then Peter right away yells like, "Stop doing that!"
I thought that stuff, it does show stakes kind of in a different way. By the way, the actor there is James Gunn's wife, Jennifer Holland, who folks will also recognize from Peacemaker and I believe Suicide Squad. Or recommend. Yeah, people would recommend after watching Peacemaker and Suicide Squad.
I recommend. I like the tension that creates, though, of, like differentiating it from an Avengers team and even what it means to be a Guardian, like when they're going to kill the High Evolutionary and he goes, "I can't because I'm a freaking Guardian of the Galaxy."
Yeah.
And it's like, that's like, there's a higher standard here, but because they're all misfits, they're like struggling with where is that standard? You know, like Peter's like, "Don't do this," but, you know, he's willing to do other things, or like, "I need to steal this thing from this guy's brain." I just like that, like flirting with the good, mm-hmm. a little bit of good, a little bit of bad, a bit of both. Like a callback to the first movie, you know?
Yeah. No, for sure. And I think Gamora having the role she did helped that a ton. Like for the reasons we were just, like the actual scenes we were talking about. But also, I
also thought Zoe did really well. P.S.
Yeah, agreed.
Because they had to like write her and she had to act different than the last Gamora. And I never, like I almost felt like I wasn't watching the same Gamora.
Yeah.
So I was like, mission accomplished. Even the way they did her hair was different. It was a little more rugged. And her facial expressions. I even thought the tone of her voice sounded a bit different. And it sounded like, yeah, I don't know this Gamora. Like, I don't recognize her.
It accomplishes a couple things. One, what you and I were always most concerned about with the decision to bring Gamora back was, will it undo the weight of moment in Infinity War? And because of this, because he and Gamora still aren't together.
Yep, good point.
Because Gamora's not even with the Guardians.
Good point.
Anymore. Like, I think that still stands. But two, it I think even actually enhances that, and it enhances the journey of that Gamora and the characters in those first two, you know, 2.5 films counting Infinity War, mm-hmm. because you see how much of a change Gamora had to go through to get to where she was, like to where we left her. And what I like is that wasn't just a, like this shows it wasn't a foregone conclusion. It shows that like it wasn't like her natural trajectory was going to take her to be the version we saw. Like it showed that like that was that set of events, they went through with Ronan, what they went through with Ego's planet. Like,
good point.
And so it makes those more meaningful, I think. And finally, I think it allows Gamora as another character that I could imagine not coming back. But if she did come back, talking about kind of setting up classic Marvel cosmic stuff, I think we're getting this Gamora is out there as the deadliest woman in the galaxy. She's not there as a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Good point. Okay, this is totally random, but we have to talk about Rocket's backstory. We've gone an hour and a half, and we haven't gotten into Rocket and like the main part of the story. Couple things I absolutely loved. I loved the pacing of that storytelling, how we got the flashbacks. But if you're going to have Rocket incapacitated for 2/3 of the film, they had to find a way to still have Rocket in the movie. And I thought that was a good way to do it. Every time he's in that unconscious state, you get a little flashback to another part of his story, which was as tragic and heartbreaking as you'd imagine. So I thought that whole thing was executed well. But then I told you the main driver of the emotion of this film for me was the friendship between them all, but specifically the way Quill battles for Rocket.
Mm-hmm. Especially after what they go through in volume 2, you know, like this, because that whole movie is them being on the outs. And
you just watched it, didn't you?
I did. Yeah.
Like something I couldn't get out of my head is that very last shot before Rocket crying is Quill walking up behind him and looking down at him and listening to Rocket say he didn't push everyone away, even though he stole batteries, but Quill doesn't say anything. He's just listening. And I feel like that's like the beginning of that foundation of Quill realizing like there's more to this guy. And that being the context for this film worked so well for me.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's just all of those little moments, right? Like in the first Guardians film, the first time that you really get a sense of who Quill is, like underneath the swagger, is whenever you see his reaction to Rocket's scars, you know, when he takes all have their shirts off. And it's like that then carries through, like looking at the trilogy as a whole, it's so well paced with these relationships, like even with the craziness of Infinity War and Endgame thrown in, like I think that it's a, like that's a great example of that, of him continuing a thread and paying it off so well in a way that again feels so earned, which is a word I'm using a ton in this review, because man, like that, I just think that that's a really hard thing to pull off. Like I look back at trilogy closers, like, you know, even The Dark Knight Rises, which I like more than I think the average person, you know, I think
I like it too. Your boy, you know,
I think it's hard to do. Like it's hard to nail something like this where it feels like you are properly letting these trajectories play out in a way that isn't too predictable, but also in a way that isn't like somehow lopsided. Like I think sometimes these can get so like the final installment of a trilogy can get a little bloated because it's like we need to try to wrap up everything that came before, but also do something new and bombastic. And so you can wind up with something that feels like I had these, you know, first two installments of a story that were on one level. And then I've got this third thing that feels like a whole other entry or type of entry. And so I love that in general, but yeah, with Rocket and Peter specifically, like even the stuff in Infinity War about like, all right, like time to be the captain.
Yep.
And then like the way that, like I just kept thinking, man, mm-hmm. It's so, the more we learn about Rocket and then the fact that Rocket was the one that was so instrumental in Endgame in undoing what Thanos had done and saving the universe.
Sure.
Like, he's the one that is instrumental in getting Thor through even Infinity War and then also through Endgame. And it was like it was an actually kind of heartwarming thing to then see little Rocket and to then think that this character kind of overcame so much and then goes on to be, you know, like the one of these handful of heroes that like save the entire universe, not just the galaxy. Like it all fit really well. Mm-hmm. I am curious, because you talked about loving the flashbacks. I did too. I don't know if I loved the execution of the, like I liked the scenes themselves.
But you don't like the pacing of it.
I don't know that I liked the pacing of it. That's something that I noticed rewatching the first two films that I think Gunn generally does really, really well. The transitions, the kind of balancing the different storylines and having them come together.
This was different with the pacing for sure.
I think part of me thought I almost would have preferred a just larger chunk of flashback, or like we see the High Evolutionary and then we kind of get pulled back and find, like, whether it's a, I don't,
like 12 minutes of the whole story.
Yeah, I think like give us a little break somewhere and that's what's going on with like the same concept of like that's kind of what Rocket, I guess, is seeing or remembering or visualizing. But it just every time it was always jarring to me. Like it was like we're in the middle of a like the present moment scene, and then just all of a sudden here's like another thing from the past. But it wasn't, I don't know, it wasn't bad. It just that aspect of the pacing felt a little off to me. Like it felt like, okay, these are scenes we have to show and we're just going to pick like the least disruptive moments throughout the movie to drop them in, but it was still disruptive to me.
I don't know
what the solution would be.
I totally understand what you're saying. I'm not sure I agree with it or not yet. I noticed it was paced differently. Let me put it that way. But I don't know if I disliked it.
Yeah. I mean, I may change. That's something that could change on a second watch too. I mean, I like the way that it all kind of culminates at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like when his friends actually got shot by the High Evolutionary, it was terrible. It was very sad and effectively done. So like the payoff was there for me.
The payoff was definitely there. I like all the stuff with Rocket being like having that inventive quality that the High Evolutionary has been unable to replicate. Like, I really like that. And I like the way that we were shown that with the, like, I also love where he gets his name Rocket, like, because of like his fascination with the, like, with flight and the sky. And then, you know, that he becomes like a space hero.
Well, and I think Tanner had written in, remember, he actually was a raccoon from Earth, from North America.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is just kind of wild. And I loved him actually saying that. Rocket raccoon.
Yeah. Well, and like, yeah, I loved him saying that. I love in the final scene, or not quite final post-credit scene, but the scene with the new Guardians. We also get like the kind of original version of Groot from way, way back, which is kind of a deep cut.
So you wind up with huge, like, freaking Groot.
Yeah. It's like you have Rocket Raccoon, which is like the character's comic name, and then you have like kind of original Groot, and it just felt like a nice way of Gunn like tipping his hat. But as much as I loved all the Rocket stuff, I was just saying,
oh boy,
I don't know. I'm gonna need to watch it again.
Okay, here we go.
Parts of the like animal friend stuff was like a little. Maybe like a little too sappy for me. Not all of it, not the general storyline, but like some of the, like,
I think,
like
I felt
the walrus and the bunny. Like, I don't know that I needed.
I think I felt that.
Again, you know, we'll see how it is on a rewatch, but
I think the only explanation there is remembering that Rocket is really young in that. He is a child. So those are very natural friends to have as a child. But yes, I think I know what you're saying. I feel that.
It just felt a little, and this isn't like, this isn't a bad thing necessarily, but those scenes felt like they would have come out of a kid's movie. And you're right. I mean, that's probably the point, is it supposed to give you that like kind of innocence. But it was just a little too. Like, they reminded me of, like, characters from old claymation movies, which, again, is not even an insult, because I love old claymation movies.
That's the point, I think.
But it just, I don't know. It's not that I take issue with the decision to show Rocket as a kid with his own group of family and how he's kind of always been wanting to get back to that. It's just, like, the actual execution of those characters was, like, a little just leaning on the silly side. But it was.
That is true.
That's fine.
By the way, I just took a sip of my water and I was reminded of something I wanted to bring up. This is so random, but check this out. One of our listeners, Joshua, makes these custom coasters. This might not focus, but how dope is that? They sent me some coasters.
That's cool.
And check this out. I'm bringing this up for another reason. Today, in the mail, en route to the studio, I got a baseball bat from, look at this.
Holy cow.
An actual baseball bat from Cooperstown made out to me, Kyle Sconewill, our logo, and look what they put on here. Can you read this?
No time.
Check this out. You're going to love this. So shout out Anthony. It's not just one, it's two. And look what Robbie Earls says.
Wow.
What does Robbie Earls say? I don't want to get into it, but, and then parentheses gets into it. How amazing
That's
is
incredible.
That? So our
That's
listeners are unbelievable.
Gift.
So
Man.
This is actually perfect timing because you're coming to Nashville this weekend. So I'm going to see you in person, and I have some coasters and some a baseball bat to give you. Unbelievable listeners. So shout out to all of you guys. I just thought of that because I saw my coaster while I was getting some water.
That's wonderful.
This movie was so freaking good. Such a good conclusion to the trilogy. And my wife loved it. Annika loved it. I would say the last like three or four films that we watched together, including No Way Home and Quantumania, I liked more than her. This one, I don't even know. She didn't have a single qualm with it for whatever reason. So this was the film where she was all in. I need to see it a few more times because I'm sure there are some things we're forgetting, and there are some jokes that I wish I'd written down, mm-hmm. but I didn't have a chance to write down. But just in general, like off the bat, like my gut told me, I think this is critically and preference-wise a better film than anything we've gotten besides No Way Home since Endgame. So right away, yeah. I'm like thinking I'm going to be somewhere in the 7 to 10 range right off the bat. Yeah. It's kind of my first gut. But what else have we missed? Like, what else have we not talked about?
I mean, I definitely will need to go back through and watch as well. A couple of just, aside from that, you know, we'll talk more about the High Evolutionary. I really love the way that character is portrayed. I really love the way it was written. I think that that's been one of the weakest points of this franchise. Going back, like certain, yeah, not that they were bad, but I think for films that have done certain other things so well, but I did love that, like, it's a personal villain still. Like, he's so linked to Rocket. He's got the, like, maniacal thing, but Peter calls it out to be like, I don't want to hear another speech about how you need to rule the world. And just their entire confrontation, which does wind up being a face-off and not a trap.
Yes.
Like, all of that I love. I love the way he reacts. It's just, like, everything that I want from a villain.
The phone call.
The High Evolutionary gave me.
When he's screaming at him. He goes, he hung up. Well, what did you expect?
Yeah, she's like, no, I love that.
By the way, though, I just love that that is like such a perfect picture of where Peter is at and how he's changed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's gone through so much now that I love that he says that. Like, I don't need another speech, okay? This is so stupid.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like we've gotten that from Ronan, from Ego, from Thanos.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I can't forget is I loved Cosmo.
Cosmo.
And I loved the craggling Cosmo, like the good dog thing, like that final moment. The payoff, like, I mean, you saw it coming, but the payoff was still great.
When she saves him. The dog.
And so in general, yeah, like the nowhere stuff, it was just all... I would say I was surprised by how many folks around me in the theater had not seen the Guardians Holiday Special and how much work that wound up doing. I mean, like...
Well, because of Nowhere.
We never... Yeah, I mean, well, and he references back to Mantis being his sister, which is kind of a big thing that you had not seen that special, you would be like, wait. If you're listening and you haven't seen that, I would encourage folks to go back and watch that. It takes place between Endgame and Guardians Volume 3. But yeah, I mean, man, just in general, my kind of final word is I've always thought that the Guardians movies, especially the first one, were great and uniquely funny and just unique in terms of what they're doing in the MCU. I have just preference-wise always been someone that liked the, like, Avengers-based stuff more. In part just because, you know, the sort of investment I have around classic Marvel Comics characters. However, I think the highest compliment that I can pay to a movie like this is that it makes me retroactively love all the other Guardian stuff more. Because of how well it ended. Like in the same, I think what Endgame did for the entire Infinity Saga, this movie did for me for all of the Guardians appearances. Like it just, it ended on such a great note that now I feel like I can come back and view this as one really satisfying story.
Yeah, I agree. There are so many more things we can get into. Like we haven't even talked about the timeline, like where do we think this actually sits and where does this happen? But there's going to be so much time for that. That's the beauty of it. So much time for that.
I do love that we got the Kevin Bacon shout out in the newspaper that he's holding.
Yeah.
Did you see that at the end?
Yes, I did. And then I liked how the intro opening role was all Guardians based and how the post credits was just shots of them from previous entries and stuff was a pretty cool thing too. Like I said, a really great celebration of what they have pulled off. I loved it. We'll get into more of this. We'll get into so much more of this.
We'll have to talk more about where certain characters can go, like specifically Adam Warlock.
Yep.
and Star-Lord. And yeah, I think that will probably be its own episode and discussion as we kind of maybe project and talk through stuff. But I am fascinated to see how folks in general respond to this movie, how well it does at the box office, how it changes the conversation around Marvel studio stuff right now, which has been, I mean, there's just been a lot of conversation really since Quantumania for a lot of reasons. There have been like the
that's a whole other conversation. Like,
it's a whole nother thing. But I think that I'm genuinely curious for a movie that I think is excellent, that is also entirely disconnected from anything else that's going on in the MCU right now, and is written and directed by the guy that's currently heading up DC Studios, which has their massive blockbuster coming out in like a month. It's such a unique spot for Marvel Studios to be in. And so I will be very curious to see how this movie's being discussed and viewed a couple weeks from now.
Mm-hmm. And we will still be discussing and viewing it a couple weeks from now.
Yeah.
If you are just new to this podcast, there are a few things I want to tell you. First of all, thank you for listening. Absolutely just smash that subscribe button. Whatever platform you're on, hit that subscribe button. We just recently announced a new phase of Friends From Work Plus, which you can go check out on our website, theffwpodcast.com. Really just go there for everything, because I can't go on the whole spiel with how much you can get connected. We have bonus content where you can pay monthly for extra kind of episodes, fun new perks and other discussions, etc. And then also for free, you can join our newsletter on Substack on our website, or join in the conversation on our free Discord channel, where a bunch of our listeners are already talking about this stuff, which is, this is like the best time to do it. If you want to just break down what you thought about the movie, join over there as well. And we have a YouTube channel where I put out like a friendly reminder, which is a under 20 minute movie of catching up on everything the Guardians have done before. So there are so many things and so many different outlets and ways you can get involved with Friends From Work. Plus, we just like to hear from you. So on our website, there's a contact form. We'd love to hear from you, or on social media at the FFW Podcast. But just all kinds of places.
And I want to highlight something you just said there about the friendly reminder video. Because if you are listening to this and you really love the movie and are maybe planning on going to see it again, and maybe taking friends that haven't seen it or family that is just not familiar with the larger MCU story, these videos are designed for that exact situation, so that you can show folks, hey, this is everything that's happened with these characters. You're going to know everything you need to know to kind of get all the different inside jokes and ins and outs and all that. So if you are looking for something like that, that's why we've created this. So go on to our YouTube channel and you'll find that there.
Absolutely. So thanks for listening. That's the first and best way you can support us. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for checking out those other outlets I was talking about. And thank you for supporting our partners. And then ultimately just sharing this podcast and listening to it with your friends is the best way. And so we are so grateful for all of you. This has been a really fun journey, and we're just getting started breaking down more Guardian stuff and then Secret Invasion in June. So if you're interested in those kind of things and where the MCU is going, we would love to be a part of your regular weekly routine. So thank you for listening. We'll be back here next week talking more of this kind of stuff right here on Friends From Work.
Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull, Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern. Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.